listening to Pythagoras' Trousers.
Hello and welcome to this month's Pythagorean Astronomy with me, Chris North.
And me, Edward Gomez.
And we're in person again in the same room.
Yes, that's right. Slightly echoey room this time, but it's good to see you again, Chris.
Yeah, it's the last one of the year, so we're recording this just before Christmas. We thought what would be good was to look at a few of the stories we've covered and some updates on them, and then a little look forward to next year and what 2024 holds. So a couple of solar system missions that we've covered over the year. The first one is an asteroid sample return mission called OSIRIS-REx, which went to Bennu, an asteroid called Bennu. It's a potentially hazardous asteroid. I think it's one that at some point in the future may hit the Earth, but we're safe for the time being, aren't we?
Yeah, the potentially hazardous asteroid is a designation that gets given to a lot of asteroids. Yeah. And it basically means that it's a near-Earth asteroid whose orbit could take it on a path that's very close to the Earth. And it's big. So there are asteroids which are on paths that are close to the Earth that are not potentially hazardous because they're quite small.
So they burn up in the atmosphere.
Exactly, yeah. Or they'd you'd expect them to be deflected. But this one's quite big. It's also an asteroid which looks like it's quite rocky. And that was one of the reasons that the mission was chosen to go there. Some material was scooped up in a big thermos flask, or quite a small thermos flask, actually.
Yeah.
It was 60 grams, which the number 60 sounds quite large, but it's about 5 tablespoons full of asteroidal material, which isn't really that much.
But you don't need much to do these experiments. The experiments they proposed, they do these on tiny grains of the stuff. So 60 grams actually goes quite a long way, I guess.
Yeah, and some of it isn't destructive as well. Things like doing a computed tomography, an X-ray of the grains to find out what their structure is on the inside, so that you know what sort of processes went into forming the grains and the asteroid itself. So that informs you on, you know, what the solar system was like when it was forming. And so far, what has been discovered is that there's a lot of carbon and a lot of water in there.
So the carbon isn't a surprise, right? Because
there's lots of carbon
there in the early solar system. The water, I guess, is potentially more interesting.
Yeah, and water is an interesting thing because we don't really understand why the Earth has a lot of water and nothing else really has a lot of water. And so the theory was that comets brought all the water to the Earth during one of the periods of bombardment as the solar system was forming, and that's it. But the fact that asteroids have quite a lot of water on them, and actually from various different asteroid missions, we learned that the boundaries between comets and asteroids have blurred quite considerably. You always think of asteroids as being chunks of rock and iron, but actually a lot of them have a little snow on them, these frozen ices, and comets are a lot dirtier than people thought. So it's maybe not surprising that Bennu does have a lot of water on it.
And actually, you don't need to. I mean, Bennu is not one of the largest things in the asteroid belt, but it is, as you say, it is pretty large. But you don't need horrendously many of things of the Bennu size to have delivered water to the amount of water that we think would have been delivered to the Earth. So you need, you need probably thousands of them, but there were a lot of these things. There's a lot of asteroids out there.
Yeah.
To have hit the Earth in the early days. And we're talking like 4.5 billion years ago.
Yeah, that's right. When the solar system was sort of a few hundreds of millions of years old.
So this is some of the oldest stuff we will have ever analysed. I mean, asteroids are primordial, they're pristine, they've not been weathered, they've had a little bit of sunlight shining on them, but that's basically it, and there might have been collisions between things. But they are, that is why they're so interesting in terms of their pristine content. I think there's a little bit of it now in the UK, from what I remember seeing, that there's a lab in the UK, maybe the Open University has got a bit of Bennu.
Yeah, 70% of it, I think, was kept by NASA, and the rest of it was sent around the world to be investigated. There's several hundred researchers around the world, something like 200, who have a little bit of this 30%. And like you said, Chris, you can do a lot with a very, very small amount.
So I'm sure the results from that analysis will be coming out in coming months. So hopefully there'll be more in 2024. Some of the analysis does take a while to study it, so I'm sure it'll be coming out over the coming months and years as well. But Bennu is one of a number of asteroid missions we've had. So I mean, this year there's been a lot of asteroid missions, either finishing their missions, completing their missions, or launching. So I'm going to forget half of them now. But we had, as well as OSIRIS-REx, we had Hayabusa 2. Was that this year? Or was that last year? I can't remember now. Another one that went to Ryugu, which was another asteroid, and brought samples back. We've had DART crashed into an asteroid.
That was quite exciting. And the network of telescopes that I worked for had quite a lot to do with that.
And then we've had Lucy launching out to the Trojan asteroids of Jupiter, so out sort of trailing Jupiter in its orbit, and then Psyche, which is a mission going to an asteroid called Psyche as well, which is a very metal rich asteroid, which is interesting. So it's been a bit of an asteroid heavy year in terms of missions, I guess. It's not just been asteroids, though. There have been lots of other things as well. So Chandrayaan 3, which is an Indian mission to the moon, landed a rover on the moon back in about August. The lunar rover landed, hopped around, which was one of the little tests they did, and then worked for the rest of that lunar day. Of course, a lunar day is 2 weeks long because it takes about four weeks for the moon to go around the Earth, and if we could go, and it's a day on the moon is 4 weeks long, about 28 days long. So it did its hop, and then it went to sleep when it went to nighttime on the moon, and then sadly didn't wake up, which was it's always a bit of a long shot with these things. It gets cold, right? Cold and electronics don't always work so well.
Well, and also it was at the South Pole, so it was entirely solar powered, and being at the South Pole, the illumination on the South Pole is sporadic. And that's one of the reasons that they wanted to go there, was because nothing's ever been to the South Pole of the moon before. And it has a huge wealth of water there that scientists wanted to explore and see what the water was like. And, you know, for potential manned or crewed missions to the moon, having some source of water is important for all sorts of reasons, not least for you to drink. So having a good, reliable source of water there was one of the things I wanted to investigate. But of course, there are mountains at the South Pole, and those cause shadows. And unfortunately, the lander Vikram couldn't get enough sunlight to wake back up again. So it achieved its primary goals, but then couldn't wake up again. But at least it didn't crash like Chandrayaan 2 did.
Yes, yes, which is
there's only a very small number of nations that have done this type of soft landing on the moon, though. So you know, that's a massive success story for the Indian Space Agency. And actually, when you look at the footage of the control room, another huge success story is the diversity of people that you see. It's old and young, male and female, all there contributing to this, which when you compare it to, I know it was a different era, but the Apollo missions, where it's all predominantly young white men, and a few older people smoking cigars, looking stressed at the back. It's in stark contrast to that, and really hopefully shows us a new era of this space flight and space exploration.
Also done on a much lower budget than a lot of
extremely lower budget. Yeah. So a reason to talk about this again is that they had extra fuel left over from the orbiter of the Chandrayaan mission, so they've sent it back to Earth. Something that very often happens unless you've got people on it.
Earth orbit, at least, so it's not going to land or anything like that. And it's a pretty high Earth orbit. It's like 100,000+, over 100,000 kilometres away, so it's not going to crash into any satellites or something. But they've done some experiments at looking at the Earth with this thing, right? Which is always interesting. We don't get many opportunities to look at the Earth from those kinds of distances.
Yeah, absolutely. Because all of the satellites are in, you know, a lower Earth orbit, except for the geostationary ones, and then not even there that far out.
Mm. Yeah. So Chandrayaan 3, the propulsion module, the engine that took the stuff to the moon, is doing that. Coming back down to Earth, we have some aurorae that we've been seeing over the years. There's been quite a lot of stories. They've been in the news a lot more. I don't know if it's this year, I guess, whether it's been social media or better cameras out there or what. I'm not sure what the difference is, but there's been a lot more awareness of the Northern Lights here in the UK, the Aurora Borealis, and people snapping, frankly, quite staggering photos of these things.
Yeah, and I think because of, and it's very difficult to say with aurorae, the solar maximum is approaching, so the activity of the sun is increasing at the moment, which could be a factor. And one of the problems that we have in Northern Europe is weather, and actually being able to see through clouds on clear evenings is a massive factor. So it's you know, one of those not really sure why, but we have seen from Wales the aurora, and actually a few pictures that were taken by astrophotographers have won awards in astrophotography competitions this year of the aurora from Wales, which is quite an amazing thing. When I was a child, I always wanted to see the aurora, and I finally got to see it back in 2016 from Iceland, close to the solar eclipse then, and that was really quite wonderful. But there's been, you know, a few. In fact, the last few days there was an event, an extremely powerful event that was seen on the sun that could have some effect on the Earth, causing radio interference. So, you know, the sun is an active star, not as active as many a star that we can see out in the universe, but the sun does have this ability to send stuff our way that can have a massive effect that we can't really do much about.
Yeah, and it can cause, as you say, it can cause radio interference, but there's the potential for when this material hits the Earth, it energizes the Earth's magnetic field and all the particles there. Some of those flow down the field lines, they create the aurorae, but they can also interfere with power systems and communication systems and so on. So the national grid here in the UK is always having to adapt and cope with the fact that there's these charged particles flying through the atmosphere, and charged particles and electricity don't always interact that well. They have to protect the national grid from solar storms, which, that's why the Met Office now has a space weather department. It's really important for us to keep track of where these are. There are spacecraft positioned between the Earth and the Sun, just looking out for stuff coming towards us. Because it can be hard to... Actually, when it's coming straight towards you, it can actually be hard to track. You can't see its motion.
Yes, that's right. So yeah.
These spacecraft just literally pick up the particles as they come past, and you get... From there, it's about 1 million miles away, about 1.5 million kilometres away, and you get a few hours warning, I think.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, because obviously the signal that the spacecraft's been hit will be relayed back via light in some electromagnetic way. So it's going to be much, much faster than the particles.
So you do get that little bit of advance warning. But yeah, more aurora as we approach solar maximum. Keep your eyes out for new stories of aurora being visible. You need basically a clear northern horizon, a clear flat northern horizon. And I say that as if I've not actually seen a good shot of the aurora myself. They are much more impressive to a camera typically than they are
by eye. Yeah.
Because it can do a long exposure. But there's still something I'd love to actually see properly one day. I need to get myself to Iceland or
somewhere north.
Norway or something. Speaking of solar events, if we look forward to next year, there's the second in two quite closely timed solar eclipses hitting North America, actually North and Central America. So there's I think it's the 8th of April, there's a solar eclipse tracking right across the middle of the US and a little bit of Mexico as well. So if anyone happens to be in the US, I don't know whether you're planning on going. I don't think I'll be there, but it's worth having a look. It goes through a lot of populated areas. It's going to be like the one earlier this year and the one a few years ago, again, tracking across the US. One of the most photographed solar eclipses in history, no doubt. There's actually a spot in the middle, I forget which state it's in, there's a spot in the middle of the states that actually got both of them, somewhere in Texas, I think, that got the one that was back in this year, in early this year, was it February, I think, and then there's another one, coming in April that it'll see as well. So a few sweet spots to go and look out for.
Yeah, it's quite amazing for an eclipse to go to go quite neatly across a whole landmass like that. So hopefully there'll be a lot of eyes safely viewing the sun during this period.
Yes, yeah, so do be the 2023 one's October, not February, but do keep your eyes out for that. And if you are looking at it, of course, look at it safely. There'll be lots of photos coming in April, no doubt. Sticking with things happening next year, actually going back to the things we've talked about already, we're going to hear more about results from some of these asteroid missions. We talked about a few of the asteroid missions that have launched. There's even more on the way. We've got Hera is launching to, which is a European Space Agency mission, launching as a follow-up to DART. This is quite rare to have two, it's happened a couple of times in the past, but two spacecraft visiting the same object in sort of quite quick succession. We've had it with comets that there have been impacts on, and Temple 1 had two missions past it. But this one, DART hit the binary asteroid, Didymos and Dimorphos, and it changed the orbit of the smaller asteroid around the bigger one. And then here it is going to look at the results and see what's changed. So that launches next year. It'll take a while to get there.
Yeah, interesting. That there was this foresight to do this. And it's also a big gamble. If there hadn't been anything, if DART had missed, for example, then what would have been the point in having the Hera mission? So they really had to succeed with that, which they did.
Other missions that are launching, we've got Europa Clipper is off to go and study Europa. Again, it takes a few years to get there, so don't hold your breath in terms of images, but that's going to do some observations in conjunction with JUICE, which is the big European mission to the Jupiter system to look at its icy moons as well. A lot of interest in that and the subsurface ocean of Europa particularly, and whether there could be life there. I don't think we're going to get an answer to that of these missions.
No, but certainly they'll see more of the vents that we've seen, these cracks in the surface of Europa, which seem to be venting material in plumes, that people have drawn all sorts of conclusions about what this under this lake that's or ocean underneath the ice layer contains, because it appears to have biomarkers coming through, things that could not be produced without some biological element, some chemicals.
Yeah, there's lots of tentative hints. We've seen lots of shots of these plumes of water vapor mixed with salty stuff. With things like the Hubble Space Telescope, observing it kind of silhouetted against Jupiter, but they just happen to be going off when we're looking at it. So to actually have a detailed observation, you know, regular observations of it from orbit will be fascinating. Other missions that are launching, there's some commercial ones. So we talked about Chandrayaan 3 and landing on the moon on a relatively low budget and try and demonstrate that you can do things like land at the South Pole and look for fuel and so on. NASA has a big commercial lunar payload services mission, which goes by the catchy name of CLPS. But a load of industry in the US particularly, and I think some international companies as well, are putting together missions to go and land on the moon and to go and demonstrate that they can do in a commercial sense.
Yeah, it's actually a little bit worrying from a scientific point of view, because you could spend decades planning your extremely well-crafted science mission that will study, for example, a crater on the moon, and then a commercial organization could launch a rocket fairly cheaply and splat right in the middle of your crater and your decades worth of and your delicate instruments, and they could completely destroy that, because the moon's not owned by anybody, so they could just do that.
And that's in United Nations kind of, I don't know, it's a law, but a outer space treaty, right? Is that yes. the moon is not the property. You can plant whatever flags you like.
Yeah, exactly.
But the moon doesn't belong to anyone. So companies can't go and stake a claim to any particular bit of it. I guess the side effect of that is that companies can go and do whatever they like on the moon and no one can stop them because it's no one's property. So, for example, some of these missions are going to test whether they can mine ice from maybe near the South Pole, maybe other locations. There's people going, can they do a sample return? There's actually a sort of a golf cart-sized rover going there, robotic, so there's no people on any of these missions. But again, that's a fairly chunky thing for a private yeah. company to go and try and launch to the moon.
Well, I hadn't seen that since, what was it, Apollo 14 and...
17, I guess, had a little rover.
Yeah, that was back in, what, 1972, I think?
Yeah, so it's been a while since we've seen any rovers of that size. We've got these smaller ones from missions. But I don't think... I mean, there have been several attempts from private companies to land landers on the moon in recent years, but they've all, often through places like the UAE and so on, but with private companies funding it. And they've not had much success. And it's hard, that's true, but it'd be interesting to see whether any of these missions actually, you know, work.
Yeah, it is quite interesting because there was a spate of companies completely failing at it, particularly Virgin Galactic, yeah. you know, failing to get to orbit and then being declared bankrupt. Mm. And it would have been tempting to think, well, okay, it was a different kind of space race and SpaceX was winning. Well, SpaceX kind of is winning at the at launching into low Earth orbit. But, you know, with Starship, they're going to be able to go further. But now these commercial smaller rockets, because they don't have to take people, they can also, you know, start to grow. And that is significant because it means that SpaceX doesn't dominate the market, and so they don't get to dictate, you know, what what happens from a scientific point of view.
I guess it'd be interesting because, yeah, Spaceship with its Starship rocket that it's had a couple of test launches out that are getting slowly, slightly more successful, but none have been completely successful yet, is the idea, yes, you can send people to the moon with a crew on board and so on. But I guess the other thing they could do is send lots of small satellites on one rocket. Which they may find is maybe that ends up being commercially more efficient. I don't know. But having more companies able to do this is probably a good thing. Although, as you say, that is commercialization of the moon a good thing overall? I guess the jury's out on...
Yes, it's too early really to say.
So that's a few things happening in 2024. A few things to look out for. I'm sure there'll be lots of other fascinating things to talk about over the next year as well. So for the final time in 2023, don't forget you can find past episodes of Pythagorean Astronomy at pythagastro.uk. You can also subscribe to the podcast and find all the previous episodes. So all that's left to say is Happy New Year and goodbye.
Goodbye.
You've been listening to Pythagorean Astronomy, an extended version of this month's Astronomy Roundup from Pythagoras' Trousers, a weekly science and technology radio show presented by me, Rhys Phillips. You can catch up on full episodes of Pythagoras' Trousers, subscribe to our podcast and get in touch by going to www.pythagoras-trousers.radio.fm.